This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
I want you to picture the battlefields of the Mediterranean, like back in the 3rd century BC.
Setting a dramatic scene today, I like it.
Right. But I don't mean the chaotic, you know, romanticized clashes you see in Hollywood movies. I mean the grim, tactical reality of it.
Just dust and colliding empires.
Exactly. And amidst all that landscape, a Roman legionary draws a sword. But it's not some massive, intimidating broadsword, right? It is the gladius.
The short sword.
Yeah, short, brutally efficient, and designed for one very specific purpose, which was tight, maneuverable, close-quarters combat.
Yeah, right.
And the genius of the gladius wasn't really just its sharpness. It was how it completely changed the tactical geometry of the battlefield.
Because it let the Romans fight in those really dense, highly coordinated formations.
Exactly. They swept right through enemies who were wielding longer, clumsier weapons. It was just a superior tool that fundamentally changed how the fight was fought and, you know, ultimately altered the course of human history.
It's a classic historical pivot point, really. You don't always win by bringing a bigger weapon to the field. Sometimes you win by just changing the underlying mechanics of the battle itself.
Which, believe it or not, brings us to the actual focus of today's deep dive.
Here comes the pivot.
Yeah. We're mapping that exact concept onto Silicon Valley, specifically in 1999. Because it was essentially the 3rd century Mediterranean all over again.
It really was.
You had these warring city-states, right? Companies like 3DFX, ATI, Matrox, S3, and NVIDIA all locked this vicious fight for dominance in the emerging computer graphics market.
And it was an incredibly noisy, just cutthroat environment back then.
Super cutthroat. But amidst that chaos, NVIDIA's CEO, Jensen Huang, was quietly forging his own Gladius.
And that piece of technology would actually go on to reshape our modern computing infrastructure, like just as profoundly as the Roman sword reshaped the ancient world.
So today we are diving into a single, brilliantly detailed book chapter provided in our sources, and it's titled The Weapon Called GPU.
It's such a great read.
It really is. Our mission today is to explore how one company didn't just win a hardware war, but completely redefined computer architecture, toppled an industry giant, and basically set the stage for the artificial intelligence revolution we're all navigating right now.
And what stands out in this source material isn't just the technical evolution, it's the strategy.
Yeah.
I mean, this chapter is basically a masterclass in how taking ownership of language, designing cooperative economic ecosystems, and, you know, betting entirely on a radically different way of processing information parallel thinking can allow an absolute underdog to conquer an entrenched market.
Well, let's start with that entrenched market, actually, because the computing hierarchy in 1999 was incredibly rigid.
Oh, absolutely.
To understand what Jensen Huang was up against, we kind of have to look at the power dynamic of the motherboard.
Yeah.
Intel was just dominating, and the CPU was the undisputed monarch of the whole system.
Right, the central processing unit.
Yeah. Whether you were calculating a spreadsheet, compiling code, or running a 3D game, the CPU dictated literally everything, and it did it sequentially.
It was a strict bottleneck. The CPU was the soul brain. And the graphics cards of the era, they were essentially treated as its subservient vassals, you know?
Yeah, the industry literally referred to them as accelerators.
Exactly. Their function was purely reactive. They'd basically just wait for the CPU to finish its complex calculations, receive the final data, and then push the pixels to the monitor.
It's like an afterthought almost.
Yeah, and the nomenclature itself, calling it an accelerator, it kept them boxed into this secondary supportive role.
But then August 31st, 1999 rolls around. NVIDIA announces the GeForce 256.
A huge moment.
But Jensen Huang makes this very deliberate choice. He flat out refuses to call it an accelerator. He brands it with a brand new acronym, GPU, or Graphics Processing Unit.
Right.
Now, I have to be a little skeptical here on behalf of anyone listening. Rebranding a piece of hardware doesn't magically change its silicon logic, right?
No, of course not.
So isn't stealing the term processing unit from the CPU just like a clever marketing gimmick to sell more cards to teenagers playing Quake?
I mean, on the surface, it absolutely looks like marketing spin. And the broader industry definitely mocked it as hubris at the time.
I bet.
But if you look at the psychology of software development and hardware allocation, naming a concept is really the first step to taking ownership of it.
So it's about perception.
Exactly. By coining processing unit, Huang was basically drafting a declaration of independence. He was telling software developers that this piece of hardware was no longer just a dumb painter slapping colors on a screen.
Right.
It was a peer to the CPU, an independent programmable brain.
Okay, I see the psychological angle. A bold name still requires a fundamental shift in architecture to back it up. If you declare independence, you have to prove you can govern yourself.
Right, you have to do the work.
So how did the GeForce 256 actually take the load off the CPU?
So to understand that, we really need to look at the heavy lifting required for 3D environments at the time, specifically transform and lighting, or TNL.
TNL, okay.
Right. In any 3D space, every asset is constructed from polygons, tiny triangles. When a camera pans or an object moves, the spatial coordinates of every single one of those polygons has to be recalculated in real time.
Which sounds exhausting.
It is, and that's the transform phase. Then the system has to calculate where light sources are, how they reflect off surfaces, where the shadows fall. That's the lighting phase.
And before 1999, the CPU was trapped doing all of that floating point math before the graphics card even received the frame, right?
Precisely. The source material uses a brilliant construction analogy here that I love.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear it.
Think of the CPU as the master architect of a building. It was forced to draw the blueprints, calculate the structural load of every pillar, determine the angle of the sun hitting the building, and micromanage the entire site.
It's doing everything.
Exactly. And the graphics card was just the painter who showed up at the very end to apply the coat of paint. It was an incredibly inefficient use of the master architect's time.
So the big breakthrough with the GeForce 256 was moving that entire TNL mathematical engine directly onto the graphics silicon itself.
Yes.
So returning to that analogy, the CPU is still the architect, but now it doesn't have to calculate every single brick.
Exactly. It just points and says, build a Roman pillar right there, make it marble, and light it from the left.
And the GPU just handles it.
Right. The GPU has the autonomy and the math capability to execute that complex order entirely on its own.
And the performance implications of that were just massive. By offloading that crushing mathematical burden, the CPU was suddenly free to handle what it was actually good at.
Like game logic, artificial intelligence for NPCs, complex physics calculations.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the GeForce 256 could process over 10 million polygons per second, which at the time was roughly 50% faster than anything else on the market.
Which is wild, but the speed isn't even the most important takeaway here. It's the architectural divergence.
Right, this is where the source introduces the fundamental difference between serial and parallel processing, and it illustrates it perfectly.
Okay. The teacher analogy, right?
Yeah. So think of the CPU as a single, absolute genius mathematician. If you hand that genius a stack of 1,000 complex exams to grade, they will do it flawlessly and incredibly fast.
Very fast.
But because it's a serial processor, that genius has to grade them one at a time.
One after the other. And that works beautifully for tasks that require deep sequential logic.
Sure.
But rendering a 3D visual space isn't about deep sequential logic. It's about calculating millions of independent pixels simultaneously.
Right.
So the GPU architecture takes a completely different approach. Instead of one genius, imagine hiring 100 perfectly average mathematicians and giving them 10 exams each to grade at the exact same moment.
Individually, none of them can match the genius.
No, not at all.
But because they are working in parallel, the massive stack of exams gets obliterated in a fraction of the time.
Exactly.
That shift, you know, from a serial bottleneck to parallel distribution, that is the core innovation here. But having the best architecture doesn't automatically mean you win the market.
Oh, definitely not.
NVIDIA still had to deal with the ruling empire of the late 90s graphics world, which was 3DFX.
Yeah, and it's hard to overstate just how dominant 3DFX was back then. Their Voodoo line of graphics cards commanded an 85% market share.
85%.
I mean, if you were building a serious rig in 1998, you were buying 3DFX. NVIDIA was basically just a mere annoyance to them.
Wow.
But as we often see, 85% market share is usually a trap. It breeds complacency. And as the text outlines, 3DFX fell into three classic strategic blunders that completely destroyed their empire.
Well, let's analyze those blunders because they represent a fascinating case study in corporate hubris.
Truly.
Their first major misstep was trying to build a walled software garden. 3DFX basically insisted that developers use their proprietary programming API, which was called Glide.
Right.
They figured, hey, we own 85% of the market. Developers have no choice but to learn our specific language.
It's the classic arrogance of the incumbent. They thought they could force the entire industry to conform to them.
But NVIDIA couldn't do that.
No, NVIDIA, being the underdog, couldn't afford that arrogance. So they embraced open standards like Microsoft's DirectX and OpenGL.
Which just makes so much more sense.
Right, because the logic for a developer is obvious. Do you spend millions developing a game in a closed language that locks you into a single hardware vendor? Or do you build it on an open standard that guarantees your software will run on any machine?
You go with the open standard.
Exactly. Developers eventually rebelled against Glide, and the open ecosystem won.
But, you know, the software misstep kind of pales in comparison to their hardware blunder.
Oh, the manufacturing thing.
Yeah. In 1998, 3DFX got greedy. They decided they didn't just want to design the silicon logic anymore. They wanted the entire profit margin. So they acquired a manufacturing company called STB so they could build, brand, and sell the physical graphics cards directly to consumers.
Now, wait a minute. Because capturing the entire margin by owning the manufacturing pipeline, that works brilliantly for companies like Apple today.
Right.
So why did this vertical integration backfire so spectacularly for 3DFX?
Well, because 3DFX wasn't Apple. They just didn't have the logistical expertise to run a massive global supply chain.
That makes sense.
And more importantly, the moment they started building their own cards, they instantly turned all of their former board partners, massive companies like Asus, MSI, and Gigabyte, into direct competitors.
Oh, wow. So they alienated their entire distribution network overnight.
Literally overnight.
That is such a crucial difference, because NVIDIA's strategy was the exact inverse of that.
Right. The fabless model.
Exactly. They adopted a purely fabless model. They designed the architecture, but they paid TSMC in Taiwan to physically print the silicon. Then they handed those chips over to that exact network of board partners, Asus, Gigabyte, and the rest, to actually build, market, and distribute the physical cards.
Which is brilliant.
It is. The source draws a direct parallel to the expansion of the Roman Empire here, which ties right back into your intro.
Oh, perfect.
When Rome conquered a territory, the smart emperors didn't slaughter the local nobles. They integrated them. They allowed them to retain power and profit, turning potential enemies into a fiercely loyal, highly incentivized distribution network, basically.
And by not tying up billions of dollars in factory overhead, NVIDIA kept their capital expenditure incredibly low.
Yeah.
And that allowed them to pour massive resources into research and development. Which brings us to the execution phase.
The death march.
Yes. Because 3DFX misjudged the consumer's desire for visual fidelity, they stuck to 16-bit color, while NVIDIA pushed 32-bit. So NVIDIA realized they had an opening. And Jensen Huang capitalized on it with a strategy that the industry literally referred to as a death march.
Yeah, at the time, the entire semiconductor industry operated on Moore's Law, right? The expectation that processing power would double roughly every 18 to 24 months.
It's a gold standard.
But Huang decided that cadence was way too slow for the graphics market, so he instituted a ruthless 6-month product cycle.
But how is that even operationally possible? I mean, if Intel, with all its billions, is stuck on an 18-month cycle, how does an underdog release a new architecture every 6 months?
And because of that fabless model we just discussed, since NVIDIA wasn't worrying about retooling physical factories, they could run multiple overlapping design teams simultaneously.
Oh, I see.
While one team was finalizing the current chip, another team was already deep into the architecture of the next one, just leapfrogging each other constantly. It was an unrelenting blitzkrieg.
And it shattered 3DFX. While 3DFX was stumbling over their own closed ecosystem, struggling to run a factory, and failing to deliver 32-bit color, NVIDIA dropped the Riva 128, then the TNT, then the TNT2, and finally the GeForce 256 in rapid succession.
The speed of the collapse is just staggering.
It really is. By November 2000, 3DFX admitted defeat and announced they were halting all physical card production.
And then 1 month later, in December 2000, the titan that once held 85% of the market declared bankruptcy.
Just gone.
And the final twist of the knife. NVIDIA bought the core intellectual property and engineering talent of their biggest rival out of bankruptcy for a paltry $70 million in cash and 1 million shares of stock.
It is a total structural victory. And honestly, this is the pivot point of the entire story.
Okay.
I want you, the listener, to put yourself in Jensen Huang's shoes at the end of 2000. You have vanquished your only real rival. You have massive cash reserves pouring in from the GeForce line. You own the gaming market.
Sounds pretty good.
Right. The logical MBA-approved move here is to optimize your margins, pay out massive dividends, and just coast on your monopoly.
But the source material highlights a psychological driver that basically prevents that. Huang was deeply scarred by what he called the 30 days from bankruptcy terror that NVIDIA had barely survived in its early startup days.
That kind of fear stays with you.
It completely eliminated any capacity for complacency. He looks at this parallel processing engine they've built, the 100 mathematicians grading simultaneously, and realizes they've inadvertently created a new paradigm of computing.
He realizes it is an absolute tragedy to constrain that kind of revolutionary mathematical power just to rendering shadows on video game monsters.
Exactly. He sees that the underlying architecture is perfectly suited for massive, complex data problems. If a GPU can calculate the trajectory of millions of light particles simultaneously, why couldn't it calculate the interactions of millions of molecules in a drug discovery simulation?
Right. Or millions of variables in a global weather model.
Or complex financial risk assessments. It's all just parallel math.
And this realization gives birth to CUD. And we really need to dig into what CUD actually is, because this isn't just like a minor hardware tweak.
Not at all.
CUDA is a software computing platform and programming model that NVIDIA developed. It essentially allowed standard programmers, people writing in C or C++, to bypass the graphics rendering pipeline entirely and send general-purpose computational queries directly to the parallel cores of the GPU.
It was a monumental undertaking. They were essentially trying to teach a machine designed for visual art how to be a supercomputer.
Fine.
And rewriting software logic to function in parallel rather than sequentially is fundamentally brutally difficult.
I can't even imagine.
But what's truly astonishing about the CUDA era isn't just the engineering challenge, it's the financial reality. Because this was a lonely, agonizing, decade-long slog.
Right, because making a GPU capable of general-purpose computing means you have to add extra logic blocks to the silicon.
Yep.
That makes the chips physically larger, hotter, and significantly more expensive to manufacture. And Huang was forcing these more expensive chips into standard gaming computers, effectively making PC gamers subsidize the R&D for a scientific computing market that literally did not even exist yet.
And Wall Street absolutely punished him for it.
I bet they did.
Financial analysts were writing scathing reports, actively mocking the strategy. NVIDIA's stock took massive hits during this period. The analysts looked at the balance sheets and saw billions of dollars being burned to develop supercomputing tools, while the only people actually buying the products were teenagers playing video games.
They just couldn't see the horizon Huang was aiming for.
No, they couldn't. But Huang refused to back down. He frequently cited his foundational belief. We started this company to solve problems that general-purpose computers cannot solve.
Wow.
He understood the inherent limitations of the CPU. He knew there were profound problems in science and data that simply could not wait for a sequential processor, no matter how fast it got.
So he basically bet the entire existence of his public company on the conviction that the world would eventually need massive, democratized parallel computing.
It is a remarkable display of sustained corporate willpower. For nearly 10 years, CUDA produced practically zero meaningful revenue. It was a massive capital sink.
Until, of course, the world caught up.
Yes, finally.
Because that decade of lonely, mocked investment into parallel architecture is exactly what laid the foundation for the artificial intelligence boom we are living through right now.
The connection is direct and undeniable. When researchers began experimenting with early neural networks and deep machine learning, they hit a brick wall.
Because of the processing power.
Exactly. Training an AI model requires ingesting massive, incomprehensible amounts of data and adjusting millions, now billions, of parameters simultaneously. A traditional CPU would take years to process a single advanced model.
But researchers suddenly realized that NVIDIA had spent the last decade quietly distributing affordable supercomputers into millions of homes.
The GPU?
Yeah, with its thousands of parallel cores driven by CUEA, it was the exact engine required to train neural networks.
It wasn't a coincidence. It was the inevitable collision of a hard technical problem with an architecture designed specifically to solve it. Large language models simply do not exist today without the foundation of the GPU, which perfectly illustrates the overarching theme of this source material. True technological empires are rarely built overnight through flashy marketing.
No, they're not.
They were forged through long, often misunderstood journeys, enduring years of skepticism while you build the infrastructure for a future only you can see.
So let's kind of tie this all together for you. Back in 1999, GPU wasn't just a buzzword. It was the key unlocking the door between the sequential computing era and the parallel computing era.
Right.
Jensen Huang didn't just build a more efficient graphics accelerator. He built the computational engine that is currently powering the next great leap in human technology.
And, that leaves us with a compelling framework to apply to our own challenges.
Yeah.
We've spent this deep dive analyzing how a massive leap in capability was achieved, not by making the traditional serial processor work harder, but by changing the architecture entirely.
Shifting to an army of processors tackling the problem simultaneously.
Exactly. So look at the seemingly unsolvable bottlenecks you are facing right now, whether in a complex work project, a logistical challenge, or even a creative endeavor.
Are you stubbornly approaching them like an old CPU, trying to muscle through massive complexity sequentially one step at a time? Is there a way you can dismantle that bottleneck, distribute the load, and conquer it in parallel? Just like the Roman gladius, sometimes the secret to winning the battle isn't about swinging a heavier sword. It's about fundamentally changing the tactical geometry of how you fight. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Farewell, and keep questioning the architecture of your own challenges.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.